Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 30th, 2000. In the fireside room this evening, we have Cynthia Molabita and is entitled Luther and Cosmic Communio. Who are we? Let's listen in.
I think we'll begin. And the tapers may start running the tape. I'm Cynthia Molabita, and this is the third of five sessions dealing with one of the strange and difficult paradoxes with which we live as Christian people in this society today. And I think for the first time in this week and last week, we're not going to kind of reiterate what we've been dealing with. Are you new in this session tonight?
I've been kind of dropping in and out.
Okay. Then I think this will be a chance not to kind of go through the whole outlining of the paradox again. What I will do is just remind us where we are in the journey that we're taking together. And we'll do so by identifying again two questions. And I also want to say that these aren't questions that we're finding definitive answers for. These are questions we're raising and beginning to find answers for. They're probably questions to keep someone occupied for a lifetime. At least hopefully they will do that. The first question is this. If the prevailing model of globalization brutalizes those who are poor and jeopardizes Earth's very capacity to sustain life, why do we acquiesce? Why do we agree to this model of economic life? Why do we do so without standing up and saying this is an affront to our faith? We say no. The second question is, in a sense, the flip side of that question. Where in our Christian faith traditions are we offered hope and the moral spiritual power to resist and revision and rebuild economic ways that nurture communities and the earth community according to justice and compassion for generations to come? And the for generations to come is an important part of the question. For throughout the history of neoclassical economics, the history of capitalism, perspectives have been short-term, economic growth for the short-term. And this question is saying, how do we sustain communities and the earth community for generations to come? Now, we've dwelt a lot on the first of these questions. We've dwelt a lot on our captivity, our bondage to ways of life that are fraught through and through with economic injustice. We've done so in this class, and I think last night in the forum, we also were digging into that. The great peril of dwelling there is the peril that we all know well and we've expressed well. It's the peril of hopelessness. It's the peril of feeling muted and dwarfed and defeated and powerless in the midst of enormous and seemingly very complex economic realities. Tonight we'll move to a different phase of the inquiry, and that is really to look at sources of hope, to take seriously the notion that one of the great realities, one of the great gifts of our faith tradition is hope, and is the power to live in ways that embody love for self, neighbor, and other. I am going to ask us to look at one. You know, there are a million sources of hope and of power in our faith tradition. Our faith traditions, our multiple faith traditions within the Christian, the broad spectrum of Christian traditions. The place I would like us to dwell this evening is the long-standing faith claim, and it is long-standing, it's an historical faith claim, that God, the very source and power of love, the very unquenchable power of love, lives not only in us, but in all of creation. That this creation is filled with the love power of God to teach us, to sustain us, to reveal to us. And how do we begin to grapple with that notion? We will look at it today. We'll look at that notion today. We'll begin to glimpse it, dig into it, by looking at the way it's expressed by Martin Luther. Is anyone here familiar really with the writings of Luther that talk about God's presence indwelling human and other creatures and elements? Are those familiar texts? How many of us are Lutherans or have been Lutherans? Yeah, okay. Well, then we'll probe some maybe new texts that aren't as familiar to us with Lutherans. The question I would ask is, who are we according to Luther's notion that God indwells creation? And how does who we are as bearers of God, but co-bearers of God, as one of the creatures that bears God, how does that identity perhaps resource and issue in moral power for us? I've been using the term subversive moral spiritual power, and maybe I should decode that just for a moment. What do you read? What do you hear when I say subversive moral spiritual power in the context of economic globalization? Any thoughts off the top of the head?
Subversion suggests working against the system.
Okay.
More radical.
Okay. What about moral spiritual power? What does that connote or suggest?
The right thing to do.
The right thing to do? Okay. I used to talk about moral power, and I did mean the power to do the right thing. And then I began to get distressed and upset about the grand divorce in modern thought between spirituality and ethics, between even theology and spirituality. Somehow we think about what we believe and then we think about our spiritual lives. Or some people are activists and other people are engaged in spirituality. And there's somehow been a grand divorce that is extraordinarily abiblical. It's not a biblical reality to divorce our ethical life from our spiritual life. So I've decided never to talk about morality, our moral lives, how we should act in the world, without talking about spirituality, because I want to undo that divorce. That spirituality, our relationship with God, the cosmos, and each other and ourselves, is inseparable from how we live and how we behave rightly in the world. So by moral spiritual power, subversive moral spiritual power, subversive meaning from the Latin words to overturn, to turn over, to turn something on its head, I mean the courage, the energy, the will to be drawn out of, breathed out of complicity and complacency. The energy to go forward, dreaming new dreams, seeing new visions, and moving towards them. This is kind of what I mean by moral spiritual power. And last night as we were singing, or one of these nights, I realized that there are many hymns that speak about this. And I'd like us to take just a moment to sing one stanza of one of them as a way of maybe bringing into our hearts this concept of subversive moral spiritual power. If you would take the With One Voice and turn to hymn 684, and we'll sing the refrain and the fourth stanza, and then the refrain again. And as you sing this, many images come to mind in singing this, and often I think we have very individualized, personalized images. But as you sing this hymn this time, think about the dilemmas we've been talking about. Think about the despair that we've all noted and the hopelessness that we've talked about in the past few days about the realities of economic globalization and what is happening to the earth and the poor. Our singing leaders here are Sue Tong and Ron Molavita. You can start
us. Which verse?
We're singing just the fourth verse. Refrain, fourth verse, and then refrain.
Spirit, Spirit of gentleness, blow through the wilderness, calling and free. Dream. gentlest wind, wind on the sea.
Well, to me, it's a song of hope. And it's a song of hope that we are called and stirred from placidness, and that we are empowered to see new visions, dream new dreams, if we are indeed captives to a system of economic injustice. It's a song that speaks to me about breaking free from that by virtue of the Spirit of God blowing on the wind and in the wilderness and breathed into us. So perhaps we could hold that hymn of hope in our minds as we go on today and the next couple of days on this theme. Now let's look for a moment at who are we. Yesterday we looked at who we are according to neoclassical economic theory, which says that we're autonomous individuals with an unalienable right to pursue self-interest, that we will make economic decisions based upon economic gain for ourselves and our families, that we have freedom, and that our freedom as people is inextricably linked to the freedom of the market to buy and sell in unfettered mechanisms for the purpose of ongoing profit. Let's look at a different vision of who we are. And this is a vision that comes out of Luther and his notions of God living in us and in all of creation. I think when we turn to Luther to ask who we are, there are many answers. And the one with which we are probably most familiar is that we are sinners and beloved creatures of God, made righteous by the love of God manifest in Jesus Christ, justified by grace alone through faith. And this is who we are. And indeed, this is who we are. This is a faith claim that states who we are. It is present in all of Luther's writings, and it's not the only dimension of who we are. Intrinsic to that are other nuanced realities and takes on who we are. And one of those is that we are the dwelling place of God. God as Christ and God as Spirit. God lives in us, and coming to live in us gradually transforms us. First, we are recipients of God's love in Christ. First, we simply receive. Having received that love, and this again is according to Luther, slowly we are transformed into people who not only receive the love of God, but become it, live it, are moved by it to love others with that love of Christ. We read a few quotes from Luther last week, and I'll just share maybe one or two that express that notion in his writings. Here are just these two excerpts. He writes, "Christians are indeed called and made the habitation of God, and in them God speaks and rules and works. Divine power may be poured into our hearts, written as a fiery flame on the heart, making it burn with love and delight in whatever pleases God, creating new courage so that one serves the people." What a profound statement of who we become because the Spirit and Christ live in us. We talked a little bit last week about the kind of transformation of our lives, of the way we act, that ensues by being habitation of God. In Luther's writings, it's a quite radical transformation of economic life. His economic norms are startling, and we'll look at some of those tomorrow. But today I'd like to look at the fact that for Luther, God's indwelling presence is given not only to human beings, but also to all creatures and elements. Luther insists that God is present in all created things. They are God's dwelling place. Now, I think that it's easy for us to take this in an allegorical way, a symbolic way, to maybe not take it seriously and literally. And I think that Luther means it quite literally. I'd like you to spend a few minutes just listening to some of Luther's statements about the presence of God in all of creation. And Christy, your entrance is quite timely because my next sentence was going to be, and I'm not kidding, it's right here in print. My next sentence was going to be, as we hear these words, think of them in terms of the reality that we face. The reality of Earth being sucked dry, exploited, used up by human activity, human economic activity. Maybe we'll read a little bit about that afterwards, but as you hear these quotes, think about what's happening to Earth today, but also think about the visual images of God living in creation. And one way to stimulate that would be to look at the painting on the wall. And the reason I mentioned Christy is because she painted it. But the painting of the Tree of Life, which many have seen to be a kind of Christic painting that I won't say more of, but notice the startlingly creation-centered Christ figure in this painting. And keep that in your visual imagery and in your heart as you hear these statements from Luther. The first statement, God exists at the same time in every little seed, whole and entire, and yet also in all and above all and outside all created things. The next statement, everything is full of Christ through and through. All creatures are permeable and present to Christ. And again, Christ fills all things. Christ is around us and in us in all places. Christ is present in all creatures, and I might find him in stone, in fire, in water, or even in a rope, for he is certainly there. And again, the power of God must be essentially present in all places, even the tiniest leaf. God is present in every single creature, in its innermost and outermost being. And again, God is in and through all creatures, in all their parts and places, so that the world is full of God and God fills all. And this is the one I think I love the most. God is flowing and pouring into all creatures, filling all things. In short, Earth bears God. We are part of the Earth that bears God. I'd like to think together, and I really ask you here not to listen to me as much as think together about what it means for our lives as people of faith in the globalizing economy to take seriously the presence of God in everything, even the tiniest leaf. There are two questions that come to my mind. One is, what are the implications of this for our obligation to the rest of creation, our moral obligation? But secondly, what are the implications of this notion for the spiritual power that may reside in the rest of creation? How might we be fed, empowered, encouraged, enabled toward subversive lives in the globalizing economy by virtue of God's presence in all of creation? I'll share with you a few thoughts, and then I'd like to ask you to think with me and add your thoughts to these. It seems to me that the first of those two questions is the easiest. What does this say about our obligations to the rest of creation? If creation is God's habitation, then the common good that is to be served by our economic lives is not just human, but biophysical and in fact geoplanetary. The common good is very broad. Human beings' economic lives then would be judged by whether or not they contribute to the ongoing health of the entire planet, not just the ongoing health of human communities. As expressed by Larry Rasmussen, and it's expressed in this book, in the context of globalization, which affects all things, not least Earth's life support systems themselves, The moral universe expands beyond the human to encompass the earth and all its bounty. The good of all things is more than their good for us, and our own interests are relative to the more inclusive life communities of which we are a part. Human activities must now be measured by one stringent criteria: their contribution to sustainable earth-human relations. Consider that, in light of the things that we read yesterday, that ...1,000 species are being destroyed per year. Biodiversity is threatened, and biodiversity is that which sustains our lives. 6 planets would be necessary in the next few years to sustain life as we know it. 6 planets would be necessary as waste dumps and resource sites to sustain life as we know it. Does our moral obligation extend beyond human beings to the rest of creation if God resides in all of creation? Karen.
I just have a question here. Mm-hmm. Is this a notion and an idea, mm-hmm. or is it a truth? And if it's a mm-hmm. truth, it's something we can really stand on. But if it's just an idea, we're thinking, well, it's a possibility that God exists in everything. You know, it's totally mm-hmm. so mind-centered that it doesn't reach down into the, mm-hmm. the rest of your being unless you can really say that God lives in everything. And is that really an understanding of the church, or is it just a possibility for some people who are thinking in those lines?
What a wonderful question. What a delightful question. The difference between a notion and a truth claim, a faith claim.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, I think it's obvious that God lives in everything uh-huh. through the Spirit. And there's quite a lot written by some of the early fathers of the church about that too, that are more specific. And I don't know it well enough to really speak about it, but I think it's St. Maximus the Confessor, have you heard that? Who writes, and there was a book about him called From Glory to Glory, that I think was written by a Lutheran, but I'm not sure. But that's just a given, and that's where you start. But if you think about it as a possibility, then it doesn't really have the force that it would mm-hmm. have.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't render the same kind of spiritual power that we're talking about. Well, I appreciate your question. My response would be that you said, is it a truth claim of the church, is what you asked?
Given, you know.
Right. My response would begin by saying, I don't think there is a the church. I think there are many
of the Lutheran church.
Ah, well, thank you. It has been a truth claim of many Christian communities throughout history. It has not been a truth claim of all Christian communities. As far as the Lutheran Church goes, if you want to speak about is it a truth claim of Luther, it is a truth claim of Luther. But the Lutheran Church has not held up this truth claim. I was not nurtured in it, and I've been in the Lutheran Church for all the years of my life.
But do you think that the Lutherans in different statements mm-hmm. or whatever would say that it's not true? Or is it just something that hasn't been held up and remembered and lived on?
A recent statement by the Lutheran World Federation on communion, which is called the Lutheran Understanding of Communion, I kind of question that the, states that communion is cosmic. Communion encompasses all the creatures and elements. So I would suggest that it's been a bit of a subterranean truth claim. You are more aware of this notion probably than many people in this room because you're situated in the Orthodox tradition. And it's the Orthodox tradition that has most richly held up and made visible and claimed the presence of God in all of creation. It was much more lost and subterranean throughout the history of the Western Church, except in the Anglican Church and in Luther, and much more recently it appears in many feminist and eco-feminist writings, this truth claim that the world is God's body. So I would say that it's been very present in Orthodox traditions and much more hidden in other traditions. Kristen.
And it has been hidden, though present, in hymns and liturgy and a lot of other forms in the Lutheran Church, but we don't hear it. Mm-hmm. We sing about God and creation. We kind of skip over that and concentrate on the human part of that hymn. When Larry Rasmussen was here last summer, mm-hmm. he had us listen carefully to some hymns as we sang them mm-hmm. in the light of his speaking about this subject, mm-hmm. and it was a mm-hmm. much different hymn to sing after mm-hmm. listening to what he had to say mm-hmm. about it. And since then, I've been looking at all our liturgy and liturgy very, very differently. You'll see that the seeds of that idea are there, but we just kind of filter it out.
What you say is so interesting, Kristen. I mean, examples of that, one would be my favorite part of the entire liturgy, sing with all the creatures of God and join in the hymn of all creation.
Yeah.
You can see the hymn of all creation when you sing that, or pledging ourselves to the care and redemption of all that is made. What is interesting in what you said, I think, also, is the way we do tend to filter it out or not take it seriously. How does that filtering happen? When I was a little girl, I learned that you knock and Jesus will enter your heart. But I never learned to pray to Jesus in my heart. I learned to pray to a God out there. Did I ever learn to pray to Jesus? Have we ever learned to pray to the God living in the mountains? Maybe we're, in a sense, not taught to do anything but filter out this reality. Other responses to that question of Karen's.
Orthodox ethics is a liturgical ethics, and Orthodox theology is also liturgical, and mm-hmm. so that's where, mm-hmm. at that point, there's great similarity, I think. Although it's not so explicitly spelled out in hymns, but it's there, and it's certainly, but as Kristen says, it's not brought out, and so I wouldn't think that you would need to, if you were writing from at least a Lutheran standpoint where this idea at least is present, that you could write about it with, well, I just lost the word, more boldness, I guess, mm-hmm. that's not the word, mm-hmm. but more certainty mm-hmm. than say, if this is true. Mm-hmm. I don't know, mm-hmm. could you do that in an academic setting?
Well, I am doing it. It's a main part of my dissertation.
So you're not just saying if. That was just for our...
No, the if was a rhetorical if,
okay.
for the purpose of the mm-hmm. run.
I think historically, at least in this country, you know, when the Christians came to this country and encountered the Native Americans and started to understand the Native American theology, pantheism, you know, there was this reaction, and I think in part that's where we lost, at least in this country, our association of God being in mm-hmm. all of mm-hmm. nature, all of creation, mm-hmm. because we couldn't accept the fact that Native Americans also saw gods in all elements of nature. And so for 400 years, I think at least within this country, we have had this rejection mm-hmm. of that notion.
Mm-hmm.
As a reaction to Native American theology.
Mm-hmm.
And that might even be true, I'm not a historian, but I wonder if that's also true in Europe. When Christianity came to Europe, whether the original or the previous religions there were more earth-based and Christianity had to come out and be against something again. I don't know that for a fact, but I wonder.
A response?
I want to go back to Karen's question because I think it's really a critical question, especially if we're talking about Luther.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're talking about this not necessarily originating with Luther, but it being a part of Luther's faith, mm-hmm. an expression of faith, you know, did he really believe this, or was it kind of a philosophical idea and framework?
I think it sounds like he believed it.
Well, but I think he believed it. My understanding of Luther is that he really started to dwell on this idea when he was arguing with Zwingli about the presence of Christ in the bread and the wine. And that in order for him to rationally justify that Christ truly is present in bread and wine, then Christ has to be in everything. And thus God is existing in everything, all elements of creation. And so that it became integrally important to his argument against Zwingli that God is present in all things, to argue that Christ truly can be and is present in the bread and the wine.
That's an incarnational theology, then.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, that's the same rationale for icons. If God became present to us through a human being made of matter, then God can be made present to us through images made with wood and paint, as well as with words written in a textbook, the text of the Bible. So
it is indeed a thoroughly incarnational theology. It is, and again, this harkens back to more orthodox notions. It's so easy for us to, or we theologically tend to the center of salvation as the crucifixion. But theologians preceding Augustine, Irenaeus of Lyon, for instance, second century theologians, saw the centerpiece of salvation as the incarnation, God coming to dwell with us and in us. And the crucifixion was a part of that. And this notion of incarnation, the very presence of God with us as being the pivot point of our salvation, is a powerful reinforcement of this power of incarnation. The question you raised, Karen, and the response that whoever made about Native American theology and also indigenous European theologies, I think that the fear of pantheism is certainly pervasive in Christian thought. Pantheism meaning God in all the creatures, or gods of all the creatures, that all the creatures have a God. I refer to this notion in Luther as panentheism, which is a different word and a different concept. Panentheism referring to the presence of God in all of the creations and elements, creatures and elements, not that each one has its own God. And I do want to say also that the move that I am making and that we are making in this room together to think about this panentheism in light of global economic justice, and to think of the moral power that may be present to us in all of creation, or the spiritual power. I'm not saying that Luther did that. I'm saying that Luther made a faith claim about the presence of God in all of creation. Now, the theological heirs of Luther, it is incumbent upon us as theological heirs of Luther not just to repeat what he said or did and hold it as sacred and stop right there, because Luther was a contextual theologian. He thought about the issues of his time and place, and he took the gospel and read it in light of those issues. We need to take the gospel, and he took the teachings of previous teachers and looked at them in light of his time, in light of his time and place. He was also, and this is a second reason to take Luther and bring him a step forward in this way, Luther was convinced that the Word was present and spoke, that is, the living Christ was present and spoke most powerfully in places of brokenness. That is where the Word meets us most powerfully, in places of brokenness. So being heirs of Luther, being contextual theologians, thinking about the issues of our day, and being people who believe with Luther that the Word speaks in places of brokenness, we see the brokenness today of our very earth, the ripping apart of our earth. So it seems to me we need to take his panentheism and look at it in light of our context and the places of brokenness in which we are situated. And one of those is our good planet Earth. So that's a kind of reason to take Luther's panentheism and draw it into our place and play with it there and imagine what it means for us here and now. That was just a response to the question of the issue of pantheism and how maybe the fear of pantheism has prevented us from seeing the power of panentheism. Yeah. Yes.
Also, I think another reason for us sort of ignoring like a lot of the psalms and hymns is just the pressure from our society and like the notion of capitalism and the global system that's going on now. It wouldn't survive if we all thought that God was in every creature and every tree or every plant, and we'd have a hard time clear-cutting forests or and that notion also came like in the frontier attitude of wilderness. Oh, we gotta dominate wilderness. Wilderness is bad. It's evil.
So maybe the fact that it would be so dissonant with the way of life of modern Western humanity that we couldn't really take it seriously. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That bears weight. That helps to maybe explain why we haven't taken this seriously.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think we try to put God in a box.
Mm.
And to our human experience,
mm-hmm.
that he really is cosmic.
Mm-hmm.
And is so far beyond our understanding that we basically probably need attitude adjustment. And it's our view of the world.
Mm.
And just, well, two points.
Mm-hmm.
One is dominion over,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
not
mm-hmm.
that dominion is more of a caretaker than it is
mm-hmm.
of having it for your use.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is evolution. We sit there and argue
mm-hmm.
whether about evolution mm-hmm. and creation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have God in a box. Creation is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
It's God's creating right now.
Mm-hmm.
We may not know what it is, but that we those concepts we distort and end up doing all the terrible things that we do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that what we really need to do is look at, well, like I say, if you put it in plain English, just an attitude adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
We're not looking at the world as the way it should be.
But you're also talking about a theological adjustment. You're talking about
yeah.
looking at ways that dominion theology have contributed to keeping us from seeing and acknowledging and worshiping the presence of God in all of creation,
mm-hmm.
Which is one of an exciting task for theology today, to undo that. Yes.
I think from a more fundamentalist
mm-hmm.
Christological position,
mm-hmm.
I mean, considering that fundamentalism is also very widespread throughout,
mm-hmm.
As an expression
mm-hmm.
of Christianity
mm-hmm.
throughout the
mm-hmm.
world, you know, my sense is that, you know, unless you're baptized, you really don't have Christ in you, thus you don't have God in you.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we don't even get beyond
mm-hmm.
seeing God in all human beings, let
mm-hmm.
alone all creation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We don't,
mm-hmm.
from a fundamentalist
mm-hmm.
perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unless you've been baptized, you don't have Christ in you, therefore you don't have God, the Spirit
mm-hmm.
of God in you, or God in you. And therefore,
mm-hmm.
you know, everybody that I encounter on the street,
mm-hmm.
from that theological perspective,
mm-hmm.
tells me that God isn't in that person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, these are good. This question, I think it started with you, Karen, kind of probes us to think, why have we ignored? I mean, relatively ignored, not in Orthodox tradition, but certainly in Protestantism, this faith claim that is present from the earliest days of the church. Think about it from this angle for a minute. If Christ, as Luther says, Christ, and the Spirit are flowing and pouring into all things, what does that suggest about where we might, and think about what we've talked about for the last 2 days, about our feeling of powerlessness, our feeling of how do we go on in ways of righteousness, right relationship, that is, in the context of an economy where practically everything we do is wound up in economic brutality. Take that hopelessness, and then take this, I won't use the word notion again, this faith claim that the world is vibrant with the power of God. Now, the power of God as made visible to us in Jesus Christ is no placid power, obviously. It's a tremendous power of resistance to all forms of human brutality. If we hold that power, if we insist that it exists in all of this, these creatures and elements, does that suggest anything to us about how we might learn from, be sustained by, be encouraged, be empowered by our relationships with non-human creation? Do things come to mind for you there? I'm partly asking the question grounded in a conversation I had this morning with Sue and John, relating to their experience of the sacredness and the presence of God power in the waters and the islands of the San Juans. Go ahead.
Something when things are acted out, they have a different power. I just missed this last session that was here this afternoon, mm-hmm. but I think it's part of what it was. But there's a special day that on Epiphany, that our church is celebrated as the baptism of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a service called the Great Blessing of the Waters.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were in a place where you could go out to an actual stream or a lake or something, then you would go out in procession to that place. But usually in the city, we're just in the church, and so we use water inside the church. But there's a service to bless the water and to remind us that all of creation is blessed by God. And it isn't that the water is not blessed to begin with. Of course, it's been blessed. And the reason it's done on Epiphany is because when Christ entered the water of baptism, his very being in the water blessed it. And so we're reminding, that's a reminder that all of creation has been blessed by God. And it's an acting out. And so it has a power that kind of stays with you. And then everybody gets a little bottle of holy water to take home. And it's not necessarily that water is holier than other water, but it's just a reminder that water is holy. And it's those kinds of things that bring life, to me anyway, into some of this concern for creation of the earth, and that along with the disciplined kind of living through the season of Lent, it also engenders habits that habits of discipline in life that relate to voluntary simplicity.
Isn't that the time too when the Orthodox priest or bishop goes down to the waterfront and the marina and throws a cross into the water and all the fisher boys dive in to retrieve it? Yeah. You see that on television every now and then.
You know, your comment makes you think, what if in our worship, in the context of worship, we lived out the faith claim that, look how anthropocentric our worship is. And I'm not criticizing anyone here in particular, but it's almost all human. We have a little bit of water in our church. We usually have two bouquets of flowers in our church. But can we, in the years to come, can we think about ways that our worship would incorporate the notion, the reality that God is present in all of creation? What would our church buildings look like? Maybe they wouldn't have walls. I'll relate to you the story of a church community in Africa, an indigenous African Christian community called the African Association of Earthkeeping Churches. And the structure of the church building is three circular huts. This is a cattle culture. One of the huts has the cattle. One of the huts has the grain. One of the huts has the place where the people gather to worship. And they all intersect. And in the middle is the water. And the same water gets used to water the cattle, water the grain, and baptize the people. Now, there's something about that structure of worship that would suggest that God is not, that God is bigger than our human constructions, and that the presence of God is more fundamental to the earth around us. I've also thought about how we pray. I've been practicing praying. I pray when I jog in the morning. This is one of my prayer times, and I've been jogging up here up the mountain a little bit. And I've decided that, because the question I'm asking you is not a rhetorical question, I don't have an answer to it. It's a question on my heart. It's a question of how do we hear? How can we possibly come to hear the Spirit? Excuse me just a minute. Thank you. How can we come to hear the Spirit speaking to us and empowering us the spirit living out there? I don't have an answer to it. I only know it's a pounding question. I've decided I'm going to try praying that way. So I've been praying to the God in the trees, asking the God to let me hear the ways to proceed, the ways to go forward, the ways to be a person of faith in this astounding reality that we're destroying God's body. And so I wonder about how we pray. Kristen.
Well, I'm wondering, in a sense, why reinvent the wheel?
Oh.
I think that we need to look at other religions, maybe ancient religions, mm-hmm. religions that we've set mm-hmm. aside as being not related to Christianity at all, mm-hmm. When they're really just not oriented to our culture of economics. Mm-hmm. I think that that is a great source, looking to other peoples for how to hear nature, how to go out and be mm-hmm. in the environment, and to listen carefully. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to mm-hmm. listen? Mm-hmm. What am I listening for? Some bird twittering mm-hmm. or what? Mm-hmm. You know, well, there's, you know, centuries mm-hmm. of wisdom related mm-hmm. to this, which we have disregarded.
Mm-hmm. So to dig into the wisdom of the ancients mm-hmm. for clues on how to reconnect ourselves. Good.
When you talked about the church in South Africa
yeah.
incorporating the cattle and the
yeah.
meat and everything, the first thing came to me is why haven't we sent some Christian missionaries there yet to, you know, to destroy their notion and recreate oh, yeah. their sanctuary,
yeah.
you know, to fit our form.
And, yeah.
and think of all the missionary work we've done all over the world and, yeah. and you know, and destroying all these beliefs that, especially the Native Americans here. And,
yeah.
in our continent and
the Hawaiians.
Yeah, yeah. Hawaii. And now yeah. we want to go back and maybe take a look at that.
Yeah.
You know, well, maybe they had something there, you know. Yeah. And before the, you know, they had a hunting ritual in honor of the mm-hmm. spirit of the mm-hmm. animal they were to eat mm-hmm. and did full use mm-hmm. of their, you know, their body and their skin and their tendons and for thread and just every bit of honor for, you know, the sacrifice of that animal and everything. And we said it was paganistic.
Yeah.
And now we're kind of questioning, you know.
Yeah.
And now that most of those species of animals are gone and the hunt is over and, yeah. and yeah. you know, other things are slipping away from us, we're starting to question, you know, what did we do, you know? I mean, I really get impassioned about this when I read about, you know, drunkenness of shooting buffalo from a, you know, a train, you know, and leaving
yeah.
them to die in a,
yeah.
on the, you know, the dead, on the plains yeah. and stuff like that. I mean,
yeah.
I just, yeah. I can't believe that we've acted like that.
Well, thank you, because, I mean, two things that you've said that I think are very important. One is that we need to face what we've done. And that's an important part of what our culture has to do. We need to face what we've done. We need to face that we're a land built on genocide. But the other thing that you've said is that there is wisdom to be found. There remains great wisdom to be found in some of the traditions that we've ignored or repressed. And in fact, I think that that is very clearly a worldwide movement now in Christian circles. In some Christian circles, and I'll speak specifically of the World Council of Churches, to draw upon and listen to indigenous wisdoms. And maybe we will learn a lot more about how to be faithful in this strange and startling and uncharted time by seeing how indigenous wisdoms have Christianity wed to indigenous wisdoms has produced forms of faith that from which we can learn. Maybe we need missionaries from that African community. But opening our ears to the hidden wisdoms, the subjugated wisdoms, as they say in philosophy, is part of our task perhaps now. And again, if we think that we need solutions in the next year, that won't work. But if we think that our lives are to be spent charting this trail, then it gives us a little time to dig into some of the lost wisdoms. and hear what they how they can inform us. Or as you said, I think, Kristen, also the other faith traditions. We've feared to learn from each other for how many years. Now if we don't start learning from each other and honoring each other, we won't get humanity out of this mess. Yes.
I think that it's really important to learn from other cultures and other traditions that might have more insight or has been a greater part in sharing the world, the love of the world, and of like a special spirit and everything. It's also sort of sensitive. It's very sensitive business too. Like a lot of different cultures are threatened right now in this capitalist society, and Christianity can be very powerful, and sometimes it's possible to take a culture or a piece of it, or maybe a piece of spirituality, and say, oh, well, we're going to sort of change it a little bit and make it ours. Mm. And that can be harmful for a small indigenous tribe that is wanting to keep it the traditional the way it was.
Well, that's a terribly important point, and that's something to always hold up when we even think about address or learning from. Also, the problem of just appropriating the beauty from another culture without doing that in a truly honoring way, that there are great problems there. So this is another learning path on how to do cultural interface in a way that when power is very different, when levels of power are very different, those on the top, that is basically white North Atlantic culture, has got to be very careful about how we listen to other cultures. And that's fundamentally true. That's a very good point. When you said that, I also thought about the comment that Paul made today in the worship session about something about mowing down the Amazon in order to make sure we have grazing land to make beef for our hamburgers. Now, we think about that as the loss of the Amazon. We forget that it's also the loss of 90 Amazonian cultures in the last 10 years. But the business of drawing upon the knowledge of God abiding in the things of the earth, found in other faith traditions or cultures, I still think today that we are would be wise to learn from each other, being careful of power dynamics. I think, for instance, of one of the Indian cultures, and I don't know which, in which it's a symbolic move to stand like this and bow like this and say, I bow to the divine within you. I have found that to be a very wonderful notion. In fact, as a mother, when my kids are driving me crazy, I have remembered this. I bow to the divine within you, subtly done, remembering that this is a little bearer of Christ, not just a little demon at the moment. But what if we also did that to the non-human world? What if Christian people around the world were at the point where we saw trees and we bowed to the divine within you? How would that give some different shape to our willingness to mow down the Amazon so that we can have not only hamburgers but cheap hamburgers? How might that bowing to the divine within give a different shape to our economic lives? Other thoughts?
My fear is that we're so drunk with our pleasures of sitting in front of a television or driving around our paved streets and all of our comforts and going in our supermarkets and that we're just really unaware of the beauty that's still here and we're losing it. You know, we're just blind by our drunkenness. Mm.
Blinded by our drunkenness. What an incredible image. That we've almost orgied out on all that we have. drunken in it, and drunkenness does blind you to beauty, doesn't it?
I thought as we hiked through across the Cascade Mountains the last few days and how beautiful it was, that how it could be destroyed by helicopters bringing people in there and setting them down so they could walk around in those fields and trample all them.
Right.
You know,
good point. That could make a lot of profit.
We find now, the world is so small, we find a new tribe now that, you know, that you talked about, you know, 90 of them been destroyed in the Amazon. We find them now and cover them if there's any left. Uh-huh. And the next thing you know, there's some adventure travel agency that flies you in there.
Yeah.
You know, they've only been discovered for a year, and now we're flying in there and watching their ritual.
Yeah.
For a few days and flying out, you know, and the next thing they want all the things that we have, and we've destroyed them.
But so, Kristen, yes.
I've been at that point of despair.
Really?
I have. I'm sure many have. Right before we came up here, my husband and I have been here 3 years now. And when I came here, I was very surprised to find out how many people are on the same wavelength. I couldn't get over it. Living where I live in North Idaho, going on my day-to-day life where, you know, everybody seems drunk, blind drunk to what's going on. I thought I was the only one who was thinking that way. And that I was nuts or something, or you know, totally alienated. I come up here and find that people not only are aware, but they're doing things about it. And I think that the times are changing.
So, you know, we could be on what Cindy is hoping that we all would come to, is some sort of paradigm shift where all of a sudden we wake up and we make, you know, as a world community, I mean, isn't that what a paradigm shift is? When things move that seem impossible, you know?
And I am hoping for a grand shift, John, but the only thing I would differ on that is the all of a sudden bit. Because the fact of the matter is that people have been conscious and aware about these very issues for a long time. And we're a part of a stream of people that are moving towards a shift. And one of the things that was said over here that is truly important, I think we're most powerless when we don't realize that many, many, many people are becoming conscious and are deciding to take steps otherwise. So that is to be held and treasured. Yes.
The one piece in the equation that you haven't brought in is also population.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we all do the right things, if our population growth continues, we still will end up at the same place, destroying the earth.
Well, you've raised a huge question, and we could divert ourselves into that question.
We don't need to go there, but I mean, there are other pieces there too that are...
It's interesting, though, how intimately related they are to economics. I mean, much data shows that in two-thirds world countries where populations are growing, that it's an economic factor, and that once women become educated and more economically secure, the high birth rates go down. So again, we're wrapped up in poverty as even a cause of vast population increase. Comments from people who haven't made them? Okay. Mm-hmm. Ron.
Going back to your first question, which we're wrestling with, in the light of Luther's admonition to bishops and pastors, to hold governments accountable and also to lead the people in that regard.
Yes.
I like your sooner than later attitude.
Just get with
it. But I think it behooves, I think we could have that paradigm shift a lot sooner if bishops and pastors would be unafraid of standing up and addressing some of these issues en masse. But bishops and pastors are too afraid to offend their parishioners, too afraid that they'll lose the financial resource that supports their salary and supports the church. But I think that paradigm shift could happen a lot sooner if the leadership of the Christian church and other religions would all come together. And
well, the unity of the broader church is not there. I mean, we don't have the kind of strength in numbers. We have little individual congregations tied together by some quasi-synods and, you know, whatnot, and the greater church, but there's really not the strength that we have. We're not organized well enough to be a strong voice.
It always comes back to the word organized.
Organized.
Okay. I know. Always comes back to that word. Organized. We're not organized.
Okay.
Are you
at all? We need
are you
to.
Agreeing or disagreeing or what? Where are you with this?
Here, we need to take a comment here, and unfortunately, we're way over time. So let's take a comment here, and then we will close and carry on outside of the session.
I would have begged to differ with you on that, too. I remember there was some kind of music symposium for the Lutheran churches in this area, and they did a lot of a certain kind of global music, so they called it African and such. That was maybe 5 years ago. Now, you go to any Lutheran church that I've been to around, and you'll hear those same songs over again. One bread, one body, some of the Africans that have a real big beat, all of a sudden, everybody's doing that music. And so the music is making a change of our awareness globally of other people. And that voice went out quickly. So I think we are organized enough to make a big change.
But there's still some sort of patriotism, you know, for country that we just can't stand up and disagree with our government in certain ways.
Well, with that statement and that statement, I will close with the statement that Luther wrote. Read Luther's works in the volumes on letters. He wrote 1,000 letters to civic officials about public policy, about how they should act related to public issues. So it does behoove pastors and bishops who are at least in Luther's footsteps to do that. All right. Thank you all. Thanks for the good discussion. Yeah.